Any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes, sir, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. I'm Peter Hansen for the appellant, Amina Matheny-Willard. But the question that is presented by our appeal this morning is whether the Circuit Court in the City of Norfolk erred in imposing sanctions because it determined that the matter at hand had a political aspect or component. In other words,
well, let me stop you right there. Where in your assignment of error do you raise that sort of component? I mean, your assignment of error is pretty bare bones, and sort of give you the opportunity to sort of address that question and perhaps the motion to dismiss. Because right off the bat, the assignment of error is erred in granting sanctions, essentially. I'm paraphrasing. I might be missing a word or two, but that's about it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So where's this political component raised in your assignment of error?
Well, the assignment of error simply attacks the ultimate decision of the trial court. As the court knows, I mean, that's the short answer to the court's question. You know, if you're asking me whether what I've just said is contained word for word in the assignment of error, of course I have to say that it's not. That's not how I framed
well,
the assignment.
I guess what I'm getting at is Rule 5A20C2 requires more than that, doesn't it? Just to quote it, says, one that which merely states that the judgment or award is contrary to law and the evidence is not sufficient. And that's essentially what you've done. So tell me why it's sufficient to preserve these other arguments.
Well, the purpose of an assignment of error is to notify this court and my opponent what my problem is, the court's decision. The problem is that the court erred in awarding a sanction. The court did other things in that hearing as well. It dismissed the underlying request to impanel a grand jury. I didn't appeal that. What I appealed was the component of the court's action in awarding the sanction. That's the assignment of error. As I noted in the preservation of the record, there was relatively little discussion on that point until the very end of the hearing. And because endorsements were waived by the court in issuing its final order, there was not an opportunity to interlineate a more specific objection.
Sure, there's. You could file an objection within 21 days, could you not?
Well, I could, but I appealed instead.
All right.
I mean, obviously, if the court feels that the assignment of error is completely deficient and that the brief fails to relate to the assignment of error, then that's the case.
All right. Let's move on to your meat of your argument.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. The essence of the argument is this case had its origin in the statute which permits a number of citizens to file a petition and request a special grand jury to offer a presentment for nuisance. Most of the case and most of the argument of the case went back and forth regarding the degree to which nuisance in terms of, we'll call it, defalcation of duty, for lack of a better term.
The trial court put it, maladministration by a public officer.
Yeah, and I think that in that respect, I agree with Judge Martin's characterization of the case.
Well, at least that's the allegation. But there are other ways of dealing with that situation, aren't there?
To be sure, Your Honor.
And there's no case law providing, whether it be in the English common law or in our common law or in statute, where this type of application had been made for a public nuisance against a public official, is there?
I agree that there was no controlling case I can point.
Any case involving a public nuisance brought against a government officer, period, as it relates to performance of their duties?
The Not under this statute, although I think the Tullidge case is very closely analogous in that an attorney in Augusta County used another, I'll call it an antique statute, to attempt to sue his locality for moving the county seat out of Stanton. That was certainly the use of a historical statute in a novel context. And when that case was reviewed on an appeal of an award of sanctions, the court ultimately said that that it lied in good faith. While there wasn't clear precedent one way or the other, some of the old statutes and some of the old decisions did appear to offer a plausible reason for framing the cause that way. And I think this case is very similar to that.
This deals with a criminal prosecution, doesn't it?
It does. But if we, and again, I'm certainly aware that the recent cases have dealt with this statute in terms of its public nuisance, or I'll call it the property-related aspects of common law nuisance. But if we go back to the 1907 case of Jones, Johnbury versus Commonwealth, the Supreme Court of Virginia specifically states that this statute relates to the police power of the state. Because that was the argument of the appellee in that case. The appellee said, look, this statute is related to a property right. And the court said, well, yes and no. And I think that was the case that the appellant here, Ms. Amina Matheny Willard, filed was really on that earlier focus of this statute, which also encompassed the police power. That's how I would respond to that. I think it was in good faith, ultimately, and I should tell the court.
That gets to the second prong, or arguably the Rule 3I, the improper purpose in which the trial judge found it was for improper purpose, it was for publicity. How do we get beyond that sort of finding of fact? He's made that finding. It has to be an abuse of discretion at this point. What evidence in the record that it wasn't for an improper purpose?
Well, the improper, I draw a distinction, Your Honor. I think that the court was correct in the fact that the appellant announced an intention to compete for the public office that my dear colleague holds,
right?
And that this was related to that.
Well, it's more
but,
than that.
But
she,
a
so
publicity.
She solicited the plaintiffs, did she not? I mean, she said,
did.
I need five people. Not that five people came to her and said, I think there's malfeasance in the office. Will you be my lawyer and do it? She put out on social media, I'm recruiting plaintiffs to bring this action, in connection, essentially, with her election challenge.
That may be the case, Your Honor. And I don't see, again, I think that those facts establish a political motivation behind the case. I disagree.
And you're not denying that. I don't deny that. Okay.
I deny that falls within harassment or improper purpose under the statute.
I think you just said something pretty astounding to me. It's okay to bring a criminal charge for a political purpose?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It happens all the time. It's happening now. A former president of the United States is going to the Supreme Court for a political purpose. It's part of our democracy, as I've showed, hopefully.
As opposed to just prosecuting the crime. Yeah, I'll say.
Well, again,
you see the distinction. Something that's obviously criminal, if true. While here we have something that, is this really a public nuisance, if true?
If true. Could it be a public nuisance? And that is ultimately something for the jury to decide, as Judge Morton said when he first dealt with this case in 2018, which to me, astonishingly, again, my dear colleague was involved in the litigation of that case. And Judge Morton said, the parameters of nuisance, and the way this statute was written, and incredibly amended in 2009, someone in Richmond apparently likes the statute. It's really the jury's call. But in this case, the judge terminated it, as I believe the recent decision in the mandamus aspect of this case, which was rendered August 23rd, implicitly empowers circuit courts to do now. The Supreme Court dealt with my mandamus, and they said, prohibition doesn't lie because there's nothing to stop. Judge Morton already acted. Neither does mandamus apply because it's not ministerial. The judge has the power to dismiss these. I think that's the implicit holding. I think that's what the General Assembly contemplates the nuisance statute how it instructs it to play out.
Mr. Hansen, you're into your rebuttal. You may proceed, but
well, Your Honor, at this point, I will terminate my arguments in favor of the appellee at this point. If there's any time left over, thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Fatahi, you have 15 minutes. You may approach. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Judge Decker, Judge Fulton, Judge Ortiz. It is a privilege to be here. It is absolutely fundamental to American law that our courts be used to settle cases and controversies according to the law. It's inherent in the power of a court to regulate what comes before it, and our General Assembly has further recognized in Code Section 8.01-271.1 that those who abuse the system and who attempt to engage in what young people call lawfare will suffer consequences for doing that. A sanction as appropriate, either for filing something that effectively is not contains no legal argument, or for filing a document that may or may not contain a legal argument, but that is an effort to engage the legal system in activity that does not belong there. Judge Martin in this case made rulings of fact that this court reviews for plain error, and most recently addressed in a published opinion of just a few months ago in the case of Nestler versus Scarabelli. If the court finds as a matter of fact that there are, a trial court finds as a matter of fact that there's been an abuse under that code section, the trial court must impose a sanction. That is what the court did. Judge Martin's rulings were not plainly wrong. They were not without factual support. And for that reason, this court's precedence would suggest that the court should affirm. I will address briefly the question from Judge Ortiz regarding the sufficiency of the assignments of error. This is not a case with a massive record, a lot of complicated procedural history. I was actually very interested to read the procedural history in the Nestler case. It didn't lead to $200,000 worth of sanctions, as we saw in AV Automotive versus Gebrezos, the latest case from the Supreme Court that addresses this. So I was not in a cloud of ignorance when I saw the assignment of error in this case. However, the motion to dismiss that I put before the court was a reflection of the plain language of Rule 5A:20(c)(2).
And there, in fact, are a number of cases interpreting that rule.
Yes, Your Honor. I felt that it would be remiss for me not to recognize that the court has said that this is a procedural and a necessary matter. And in fact, the assignment of error in this case is of precisely the sort that the rule itself says is conclusory and is insufficient. And I recognize that the court will rule on whatever grounds are the narrowest and most appropriate to rule on. And if the court chooses that ground, I would submit, would be not inconsistent with what the court has done in the past. That said, I'm more than prepared to address the meat of the argument, one that I find very interesting. And I can't in good faith claim that I didn't know what we were here to argue, nor did I assert that in the motion to dismiss. On a plain error and abuse of discretion review, the question is, could any jurist have ruled the way that Judge Martin did? Judge Martin, I know that this is not an exactly analogous situation, but when we discuss the manner and demeanor of litigants on the stand, witnesses in testimony in civil and criminal trials, this court and our Supreme Court have always recognized that the judge in the circuit court is the one closest to the proceeding, the most able to read not just the desiccated bones of a transcript, but to see the muscle and the fat of people's demeanor and actions in the courtroom. And the standard of could any judge have reached this conclusion, we have obviously had one judge who did, and based on the record and based on what the audio and visual evidence, including what George Ortiz put before Mr. Hansen during Mr. Hansen's argument, demonstrates that somebody somewhere other than Judge Martin could have agreed with him, and that really ends the matter. The factual findings the judge made and the legal findings regarding nuisance are also actually quite interesting, and I saw in the Lawyers Weekly that Judge Martin had the opportunity yet again to address nuisance at the trial court within the last few weeks. A dive into Blackstone's commentaries supports Judge Martin's basic conclusions in his letter opinion, which is that with the exception, and this I think came up more in oral argument than it did in the written motion, with the exception of the obviously constitutionally infirm category of the woman who it was a common scold, which was a public nuisance under Blackstone, all of the other categories of public nuisance, from eavesdropping to slaughterhouses, were all related to the interference with real property and with the rights in real property. There is no legal basis, nor as Judge Martin demonstrated, was there a good faith basis for the extension of that doctrine to what both Judge Martin and Judge Fulton have referred to as maladministration. There is a code section with which I was familiar from yet another case from a number of years ago that provides for the trial and potential removal of constitutional officers for maladministration. The difference is that here in Norfolk, such a petition would have required 5,000 signatures rather than 5. And while the existence of an alternative remedy is not in itself a demonstration that the preferred remedy of a petitioner is unavailable, it does demonstrate that these two doctrines were apples and oranges, even when St. George Tucker was commenting on Blackstone.
Mr. Fadahi, what, from your perspective, what aspect of this case do we review de novo for the law versus the factual findings?
The court could review Judge Martin's decisions about whether the petition argued for or set out a nuisance properly or made a good faith argument for the extension of the law of nuisance. Those are legal conclusions that the court could review de novo. However, since the court traditionally reviews these cases on the narrowest ground available, the court could sit with Romanet 2 of the sanctions statute and rule solely on the improper political purpose. I would argue and I would submit, and forgive, I recognize I may not have quite the critical distance that the usual appellate lawyer has from this matter, but Ms. Matheny-Willard's Facebook videos led me down another detour into the law, the common law of barratry, which has been abrogated. It is no longer there, but the seeking of people and asking them effectively, forgive me, I don't have the exact phraseology on my tongue, but to come and reach with me, to come to do something new, it demonstrates that this was the prosecution of politics by other means. Setting aside the fact that the ultimate aim would have been a criminal indictment, even if it hadn't been, the filing of an otherwise meritorious action for an improper political purpose is itself sanctionable. And that the alpha and the omega of that review is abuse of discretion. That is not something that would be subject to de novo review.
Thank you.
People say that we pay lawyers to talk. We actually pay them to stop talking. So with my remaining time, I would simply say this. I've been now close to 21 years out of law school. I had the privilege of being an appellate law clerk. I was convinced a number of years ago that I would never have the privilege of conducting an oral argument or participating in one. And I have a fool for a client, but one of the reasons that I did is that it is the absolute honor of a lifetime, regardless of how this court rules, to have had the privilege of doing something new in my career and doing something that I had always dreamt of doing when I was a law student. I appreciate the court's consideration and its time.
Thank you, Mr. Fahey. All right, Mr. Hansen, you have a little over 3 minutes.
Thank you. Well, I'm honored to be Mr. Fadahi's first opponent before this tribunal.
Do you agree that the court could find, wouldn't have to touch whether or not it's warranted by existing law or well-grounded in fact, if there is an improper purpose, right? So this court could say the narrowest and best grounds is it's not done for an improper purpose. It is done for an improper purpose, so we don't even have to get to the second component.
I agree with that interpretation, Your Honor. I'm just not certain that the conclusion that the political component constitutes an improper purpose under our law. I'm not aware of any decision that holds that. The case that we did cite, Vaughn versus Gilmore, was certainly a political case. That was the plaintiffs who challenged the tobacco settlement, and they had a raft of complaints against the governor and other public officials. It was political, but the sanction was given because of the extremely vexatious manner in which the litigation was conducted, and I don't see that on these facts. I think the matter was presented. The court ruled in the way that I believe the court was empowered to rule, and the case was terminated. I don't see that the conduct of this litigation fell within the reported decisions of the Supreme Court of Virginia in this particular matter. I did want to give the court the citation. I misquoted the older case, which brings this statute under the police power. That's Jeremy Improvement Company versus Commonwealth, 106 Virginia, 482, 1907. And I do apologize for mistitling that old decision. So the other cases that were cited, you know, all seem to come out of litigation, which was deliberately prolonged or made more complex, more complicated by the party being sanctioned. The Canvas decision falls within that, and we don't have that here. We had a cause of action that was filed, briefed, and argued. The arguments were esoteric, but I think they were conducted in good faith.
And you agree that the question of sanctions is reviewed for abuse of discretion?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is That is correct. Well, Your Honors, that concludes my rebuttal matters. If there's no other questions, I'll cede the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. The case is now submitted, and we will forego coming down off the bench.